Today we have a special guest on our show, Russian philosopher and the founder of the Eurasianist movement, Alexander Gelievich Dugin. Hello, Alexander.
Hello.
And most of you have some idea who Alexander is, although some of you might have a distorted view, and we will hope to rectify it during our conversation. I will briefly introduce ourselves to you, Alexander, and for those who just found us. But before that, let me ask a traditional starting question. What are you drinking right now? I'm drinking some pu'er tea, and it's pretty nice.
I'm drinking kefir. Great. You are lucky, guys.
You don't drink anything right now, I take it. That's good. All right. So let me introduce ourselves. We are two Russian guys. My name is Nikolai and my co-host's name is Kirill. Kirill has a formal and informal training in history. And I used to be a prolific Twitter contrarian. We started our podcast back in 2020. Our main mission was to talk about interesting things and to present Russia's history and reality in English language in a different light, because we were sick and tired of being caricatured and misrepresented. And typically Russians fail miserably at the public relations department, and all that's left to our public image, be it negative or positive, are matryoshka dolls, bears, vodka, and hot women perhaps. And we try to change that, or at least make a dent in this old tired image. Alexander, you are currently the most known Russian philosopher in the world, and some of your acclaim is entirely of your own making, because you have written many books, translated them, and learned many tongues yourself. But I think that part of your name recognition is due to misrepresentation by American mainstream media in particular, and their decision to turn you into a sort of a boogeyman with which they scare average Americans. So my first question will be, what do you do with the unwanted and offensive labels that are being slapped on you, such as Putin's brain or fascist mysticist and whatnot? Or did you learn to embrace it?
So first of all, I think that there are two levels in this image. It has nothing to do with my ideas. And sometimes, for example, describing my so-called fascism, they are citing my own works where I criticize radically fascism as communism and liberalism, by the way, but fascism as well. So nobody cares. For example, in Wikipedia, there are many articles written on myself. And many topics, many issues have in them incorrect biographical facts, for example, the pure biographical without any interpretation or appreciation. And there are so many errors, mistakes there. But if you try to correct some innocent details, it will be changed back immediately. So somebody is working on this image of boogeyman, as you have put it. So and that is a kind of operation. We can call it Dugin's operation. So the West needs enemy, needs the figure, the Gestalt to blame it, to use it when it is necessary, and they have chosen myself. So that was a very serious decision. I think back into the 90s, they have made research in Russia, and Zhirinovsky was too cynical, too clownish, clown, and they tried to do the same from Lebedev, General Lebedev, as huge Russian beer general with with low voice and so on. But finally, they have chosen myself in order to create a new a negative picture of Russia. Gulag, revolution, slavery, bears in the streets, and Dugin at the top of it with his bird. So that was Rasputin's Putin topic, and that is a kind of propaganda. But there is a kind of nucleus, the kind of core, very logical core in this attitude, because it is difficult to find in the world the philosopher with so clearly anti-liberal position. So I am really, and the reality, a kind of champion of illiberalism. So I detest liberalism in all its form, old liberalism, new liberalism, middle liberalism. I reject any kind of political philosophy based on the individuality, individualism, capitalism, liberal democracy, including starting from nominalism position in the scholastic quarrels. And in that sense, I am disciple of René Guénon, a traditionalist school. So I reject the modernity, and I, on the contrary, I am on the side of tradition. So I am against the West and the modernity. So modern West, it is the worst thing that I could imagine. So there is some rational basis in this demonization. The image, finally, is totally perverted. That is caricature, I agree. But the core of this label to call me the most dangerous philosopher is not too far from the reality, because I challenge everything in the Western modern liberal society, from starting from the principles to the last results. I think that Marxists before, in the early stages, in the earlier periods, were such critics, so radical critics of the Western liberal modernity. But after the fall of the Soviet Union, there was a kind of huge, and maybe before, huge betrayal of the Marxism regarding they fight against capitalist system, and they became a kind of tool in the form of liberal classical cultural Marxism. They became a tool of global capitalist system, sharing with them the main values. So, and nobody is against. So everybody, either liberals today, or left liberals, or right liberals. So you are perfectly invited to be right liberal, central liberal, or right left liberal. But you cannot be illiberal. So you cannot be anti-liberal. And that is the kind of rational moment in this strategy. So being totally illiberal, and I recognize that, being neither communist nor fascist at the same time, so I am the perfect target for their for propaganda of all who share with liberals their agenda.
Traditionalism, which you mentioned, is just not well understood by most people who comment on such things, and it just doesn't fit the paradigm, and they don't know how to react to it, because it's outside of the modern ideologies, but they can only describe things in terms of modern ideologies. So that is an important point.
Exactly. And that is why they try to reduce this fourth political theory, my fourth political theory, to fascism, or in some time to communism, Stalinism, so to nationalism. So I am against nationalism, against all kind of racism, or against xenophobia, against atheistic, materialistic communism. But the liberals cannot deal they simply cannot imagine that their enemy, their opponent, could be outside of their classical form. So who is against liberalism? Communists and fascists. So if I'm not communist, so I should be fascist. If I'm not fascist, I should be communist. If I'm neither communist or fascist, I should be both. National fascism. So yes. Something like that. And to hold debates with someone who consciously describes himself outside of this structure, liberalism, communism, and fascism, is something they could not dare. And that is strange. I thought with Bernard-Henri Lévy, we could, or with Fukuyama, or with Brzezinski, with other intellectuals, for liberal intellectuals that I've met in my life, that this new kind of dialogue would be possible. Finally, no. They could not say anything against this forced political theory, clearly established and described correctly with details in my writings. Maybe they didn't finally read them, or there are some reasons. But the only way to deal with my ideas is to reduce to them to something they are not. And after that, debates begin, but they have already from the very start, they have no sense, no meaning, nothing.
Well, in my opinion, the people you have just mentioned are intellectuals in name only, and their work, I think, is mostly painted by a very deep lack of curiosity, lack of intellectual curiosity.
I agree.
I also wanted a question from a friend of mine, a good friend who lives in Estonia. He recently stumbled upon the information that you went to Tallinn in 1991 and gave lectures on traditionalism. And he asked me to pass on the question whether you have maybe interesting anecdotes about your time in Estonia, or if you have anything interesting to say about the country.
Well, you know, I knew interesting people from Estonia. Udom Haljand, who was one of the first to translate the works of René Guénon and Henri Corbin in Estonian. I've met him. I have visited the rests of the castle of Ungern Sternberg. Saaremaa, Hiiumaa. There was the island of Hiiumaa. Very interesting. I was there with the taxi driver, and he has told me many interesting legends about this place, about Hiiumaa, how he with his friends in the school, they have seen in the garden of ruins of the castle of Ungern Sternberg the vertical serpents between the roses, and many other very, very curious things and tales. And I had from Tallinn and from Estonia in general very positive impression, and I have known the other traditionalists from Estonia. Some of them, for example, the son of Udom Haljand, reassembled the translations of my early articles in Estonian, who his father has made, and now he's going to publish them in Estonian language. So I have this episode, not too important, but I have very good, and I got very good memories from this visit and from castle of Baron Ungern Sternberg, his ancestors. So I have composed a kind of scenario for the picture, for the movie, about Baron Ungern Sternberg, but I have lost that in my papers.
Oh, that's sad, because I've said for years that we really need a good movie about Roman Fyodorovich. I think that would be very important.
So, but it is so.
Yes. Once upon a time, I even started working on a scenario myself.
Oh, great.
I'm
interesting. We need some movie of that kind, because he was very atypical hero. He was not normal white. He was not absolutely he was anti red, but he was the kind of figure of such stature that he has impressed Evola and partly Genon as well, because he was a kind of mystical figure. So his adventures and his spiritual meetings and interests, they are so exciting, I think. So we really like that kind of movie, or maybe we have dedicated to Ungern Sternberg some events in Russia, cultural events with citing poems and showing the old Soviet film on in the backstage. So that was funny, I think. But I think his stature demands more, demands the real movie.
Yes, I agree. I was recently rereading his famous Prikaz номер 15, the order number 15, which is really eschatological manifesto and not a simple military order. Very under he's famous, but still not very well understood, I believe.
Absolutely, neither here nor there. Interesting that we've made one radio show with Eduard Limonov playing the role of Ungern Sternberg. That was a kind of simple version of scenario that I have lost. And there are some bande dessinée comics in French by Hugo Pratt, a very famous artist dedicated to Baron Ungern. And there is the book of Jean Mabir in French as well, dedicated to Ungern. There is some small circle of his admirers still there in the Europe and the West, in Russia as well, I suppose.
Yes. Another question I wanted to ask about in the context of traditionalism. I am somewhat familiar. I am consider myself somewhat of a student of René Guénon as well. And my question would be, are you familiar with Charles Upton, and specifically the criticism he has written and talked about of your work from a attempted perennialist or traditionalist point of view?
I've heard of him. He has, this man has written to me the message, saying, "I'm going to make traditionalist criticism of your work." Okay, I have responded, "Nice, do it." And he asked, "Do you agree that your main idea is that metaphysic of chaos should replace the traditional form of metaphysic?" I have responded, no way. I have absolutely different vision of the thing. So you are absolutely wrong taking that for not only for my main idea, but one of the important ideas, the idea of chaos was just the topic of my small speech on some congress. But I have spoken about so many things, so many concepts, theories, that you could not say choose one in arbitrary way and say, "Oh, that is the whole Dugin in one word." That's absolutely crazy. It's absolutely incorrect. Upton has said, "But I have already finished my book. I wouldn't write it once more. So I will keep my convention that you are the magical counter-initiatic representative of magic of chaos. So let's fix the things." I have said it is absolutely stupid, useless. Bye-bye. Nothing of that. And after that, he tried to somehow to communicate, but I have explained why I have no interest to continue to hear from this person or from the person who read his books.
Regarding the charges of counter initiation and magic and whatnot, I think a very long time ago, you used to be somewhat involved with people who could be described as such, the Yuzhinsky Kuzhok and so on, and Gaidar Jamal and people like that, and various esoteric groups. I think it would be interesting to hear from you how you view these sorts of ideologies or people nowadays, and maybe a bit about your personal, religious journey. That would be very interesting to hear about, I think.
So, first of all, these kind of people who I consider my teachers, my masters, they were not occultists, not so much esoterists. They were traditionalists. Traditionalists in very particular Soviet time, trying to find a way to tradition, to sacredness. In the situation of the late Soviet period, where nothing existed, there was the kind of very special historic experience that I had as well in my youth, that you live in the void, you live in absolutely void, there is nothing. Once I've tried to ask in some chemistry shop, can you give me some sulfur, salt, and mercury? I would like to make a kind of alchemistic experience. And they say, no, we have nothing. We have only one kind of acid to supply you. So in Soviet Union, in late Soviet Union, there was absolutely nothing. Everything was totally forgotten, totally lost. And in this situation, situation of macabre, these people, as Mamleev, as Jamal, as Golovin, they tried to break apart through this situation to find some fresh sources of inspirations, to believe and feel the ideas outside of this hellish context of absence of any kind of culture, of knowledge, of philosophy. So they were they lived in that void, they felt this void, and they, for me, they were those who have given me the way out of that. So I, but in my personal experience, first I was converted into traditionalism of Genonian type. So I became traditionalist, and in the second half of the 80s, I have entered in the Orthodox Church, where I was baptized as a child. So I rediscovered my Christianity, and from that point, I've never changed my mind. So, and I didn't abandon traditionalism. I'm totally traditionalist. I follow René Guénon in my line. I reject Western modernity. I praise sacred tradition, but in my own personal decision, my tradition coincides absolutely and totally with Christian Orthodox Church. So what this church regards to be true, I agree absolutely. If somehow I don't coincide with that, it is my fault. I recognize immediately that is my mistake, and I try to improve the position. So personally, my personal attitude is attitude and practice and doctrine and teaching. The only teaching that I have, that is Christian Orthodox tradition. But at the same time, I got a deep respect to the sacred traditions of other people. I have studied Islamic tradition. I have studied a bit Hindu tradition and other traditions following Genon. But my My church is the only one. I think that Christian Orthodox doctrine is the expression of the absolute truths that I share. And if I decline from that, so it is my fault. And if someone who can point me out where I'm wrong, I would recognize the truths of the other. That I make that, and I'm in my my proper researches. For example, I in the beginning of the 90s, I have written a book on the metaphysics of Evangel, where I tried to combine Kenonian attitudes and the doctrine of Eastern Christianity. And in every point where I have encountered the contradiction, I took the part of the church against Genon, for example, in his Nestorian Islamic Christology in other points. So I'm always on the side of the Christianity. I studied the other tradition as well some systems of beliefs of Western mystics. There are interesting aspects of that, but one thing is to explore something, and the other thing is totally other thing is your own beliefs.
Yes. What is your opinion on the current status and position of the Orthodox Church in Russia, and where is it going? How is it its influence on society and so on?
So Russian Orthodox Church is the only authoritative sacred institution and traditional institution we have. The other sacred institution is state, because for us, Russians, Christians, Eastern Christians, the state, or better to say, empire, kingdom, is not only a political instrument, as that was in the doctrine of Saint Augustine, but for us it is not only earthly organization. It is a kind of ladder, a kind of stairway to the heavenly kingdom,
and the Katechon.
Yes, exactly. The chief of the state is for us the spiritual figure, Katechon, the keeper who keeps the world in front of the coming Antichrist. So that is eschatological mission of Russian state, to fight against the coming Satan in the history. And so for us, Christian church and Russian states are both structures with immense spiritual meaning. So, but I think that speaking about church in Russia is the main important organization. But after so many hundred years of very particular, very dubious situation in the first of all, after the reforms of the Peter the Great, when he enslaved the church, he has put the church under the control of secular state. So all the institutions in the beginning of 18th century were desacralized, modernized, westernized state and church. And after that, there was the communist period of martyrdom of our church. So it is not easy to get back for the church to accomplish its mission. It is on the way. It is on the way of the great spiritual return. It is not easy, because first of all, our church from the 90s, the end of 80s, was busy only with reconstruction of the temples or of the buildings. That was the huge activity of the monastery and so on and so on. But now I think we are approaching the second period of the modern post-Soviet church history is the spiritual rebuilding of our society. So the Russian church is now in the transition between the first stage of material renaissance reconstruction to the spiritual renaissance. And that is very, very particular moment. And many things depend on the relations between the church and state, because they are two, church and state. Both, they are spiritual traditional institutions of us, and we need to revival them both. We could not depend or hope only on the resurrection of spirituality and put aside and leave aside the state, or we could not hope for a kind of development of the state and a revival of the state and sovereignty without church. So they are so strongly interconnected in our tradition, and I think that is the main goal of Russian future. And we are going this way. We are restoring now the glory of our Holy Empire, the Moscow Third Rome, the catechonic stature and title and the function and mission of our leader. That so we are restoring our glory, and maybe we are in the beginning of the more important process of the eschatological revival of the humanity in this focus of revival of the Holy Russia.
You mentioned in the question before your respect for other religious traditions that are outside of the Christian tradition, and before that about your time in Estonia, which you enjoyed, and I came to the question, your other travels, which countries did you enjoy visiting, which other peoples, aside from the Russian people, have you encountered, which you felt were maybe kindred to Russians, or maybe which you just personally sympathize with, so basically, yeah, things like this.
So it is difficult to say, because when I come to some country, to some people, I don't measure the quality of the people and society by their attitude toward us, Russians. So I'm not absolutely Russia-centric. So I try to evaluate the completely different aspect. I try to understand people, to feel my cultural ambience and the earth and the signs and the spiritual presence that is very different in different parts of the world. So I could express my impressions. So I really fall in love in the beginning of the 90s with Serbia. I don't know why. So maybe there are some historical reasons why I love Serbia. Maybe there are not so much, but when I was there in the beginning of the 90s, including in the Bosnia and Herzegovina, in the front line, and other places of the Yugoslavia, there was Yugoslavia still there. So I fall in love. I just have fallen in love with Serbia, and this feeling is so deep, it's so irrational. So I could not explain that. I just love Serbs. I don't know why. I don't know what for. But I really love Serbia, and I always am on the side of the Serbia and its tragic situation. I very much like Italia. I have so many friends. So in Italy, I have more followers than in all the world. More books published there. So. If I come, for example, last time when I visited Sicily, I was in a small city in Sicily at midnight. I came out from the car with my friends, and there was people in the night in the Sicilian city that have recognized myself and said, "Oh, we have heard you here, Mr. Dugin." So, Senor Dugin, that is very, very, very special kind of relations. I don't know why, but I understand Italians. They understand myself, we have in a very intensive dialogue, philosophical dialogue, not with one, two, three, maybe some group of the people, but with Italy. I feel Italy from the north to the south, and I have so many friends there. So, and they as well, they pay the same price, because, for example, when my daughter was killed, some Italians, they among them, very important composer, Angelo Inglese, they have composed the opera for Daria, and they have staged that different times in different theaters. So they have published already 5 books dedicated to my daughter, and they are so loyal, these people in Italy, so open, so emotionally sincere, that I cannot recognize in them Europeans. They are not Europeans. They are something different. Maybe they are Romans. Maybe the Italy is such beautiful and perfect land with such feelings of the beauty, of the truth, of the seriousness, of the heroic action. So Italy, the other land that I adore, absolutely adore Italy. In the theory, in the metaphysic, in the field of metaphysics, my beloved country is Iran. Not so much Iran as we know, as we could visit, but metaphysical Iran. So eternal Iran. Iran as the heart of the metaphysical tradition of the light, of the war of the light. I recognize the traces, the rests of this tradition, including in modern Iran. I much love Shiism, Iranian Shiism, Iranian tradition, spiritual. I have as well many followers there. I like Turkey as well. There are many people who are very open to Eurasianism there. When I have visited for the first time Brazil, I didn't know much about this country. And as well, Brazil has conquered me with its music, with its open people, with its flexibility. And intellectually, I would say, I'm mostly French, because sometimes I think in the French language, because I've started to learn with Guénon and with French philosophy, so I'm still very indebted for French culture, and above all to Nouvelle Droite, to Alain de Benoist, my great friend. So rationally, I very, very inclined to France. And finally, in the language, and not of the language, of rational language, of in the question of the language as such, I am for sure German, because every day I read some books or pages, that depends on the time, in German, because German metaphysics, it's something that inspired me, as well as Greece, but ancient Greece. So the most important, as my daughter used to say, my preferred journey would be in ancient Greece. Where do you like to go? To ancient Greece, she responded. So and it is a part of the kind of joke, but the Greece as well is extremely important country, but it existed in its philosophers, in its theater, in its culture. So in that sense, you can say that I being absolutely Russian in blood, in culture, in language, in style of living, in the soul, in the heart, in the spirit, I am very open to other cultures. I appreciate them, and I have friends that I love and who love me as well in all the world, in Arab world, in the United States as well. You cannot imagine. I have many friends there, and the kind of dialogue with them is very enriching. So against all this liberal elite, there are other America, and it's very interesting. So I don't despise any people. I was in India, in Japan as well, in many other countries, and almost everywhere I find something that is worth to love, to know, to explore, to have friendships. So the world is full of beautiful things, beautiful landscapes, beautiful historical places with beautiful, beautiful people, in spite of this globalization.
Yes, Russians seem to have this trait of easily falling in love with different cultures. So in a way, we are a very cosmopolitan even nation. But there is a question, is global tourism as an extension of globalization a net harm on humanity as a whole? And what do you think about the global tourism?
Yes, I simply hate it. I hate it. I think that is the worst thing to be tourists. It is just a kind of accusation, insult.
But you're also a tourist, no?
So tourist, it is a kind of underhuman to be. It is just a beast, a globalist, liberal beast who don't understand anything in the culture. You shouldn't be tourist.
Very first thought when you heard of the beginning of the special military operation and after these 9 long years?
I thought, finally, second thought, maybe too late. Third thought, we will pay for that a huge price we don't imagine yet.
That's enough for a free version. A full 2-hour version of our conversation can be accessed on RWA, Patreon or Gumroad. Go to a description box and pick any membership tier you want. And you will get a full access to all of our interviews, historical episodes, military analysis, news digests and cultural exploration. And besides, you will get access to our secret chat, where we will be hosting Russian lessons for everyone who is interested. I think it's a pretty damn good deal. See you there.